Welcome to Unframed. I'm your host, Anthea Pockroy, and I'm delighted to welcome my talented co-host for this season, Nkgopeleng Moloi.
I'm excited to be here and to embark on a journey through the intricacies of the South African contemporary art landscape with you and our listeners.
Season 4 offers a more thematic approach than previous seasons, where each episode will examine a different facet of the South African art ecosystem. From the artist studio to the gallery, the curator to the museum, we are delving into the complexities that define our industry.
Join us in considered conversations with established artists and industry experts who will offer insight and inspiration. If you're seeking a more nuanced understanding of the art world, Unframed Season 4 invites you to come with us on this journey through the South African art ecosystem.
This is Unframed, where we create space for dialogue about the contemporary art world in South Africa. In today's episode, we delve into the role of the Biennale, a pivotal contemporary art exhibition in the global art landscape. We are joined by Clive Kellner, Executive Director of the Joburg Contemporary Art Foundation, whose career spans 25 years and holds significant involvement in South Africa's art history since the country's democracy in 1994. Notably, and pertinent to this conversation, with the historic Johannesburg Biennale. Also with us is Amay Bell, Director at David Crit Projects and Curator of the South African Pavilion at the 2022 Venice Biennale. Clive brings insights into the historic 95 and 97 Johannesburg Biennales, reflecting on the impact, significance, and challenges of these events. Amay shares her experiences and perspectives from curating the South African Pavilion in Venice, offering insights into the contemporary dynamics and global influences of biennales. Together, we explore the meaningful contributions and limitations of biennales within both the local and global contexts, from accessibility and representation to the broader impact of large-scale exhibitions on the global stage and the diverse participants they attract. Join us for this insightful exploration of the Biennale with Clive Kellner and Amay Bell. This conversation is about the Biennale, and we're trying to position it within the arts ecosystem, looking specifically in South Africa at the 95 and 97 Johannesburg Biennale, and looking more globally and using Venice Biennale as one of the examples. But we'd just like to offer a definition about what a Biennale is. So a Biennale is a large-scale exhibition of contemporary art named for its host city and is typically managed by a combination of public art museums, government agencies, and philanthropic supporters. And it usually works in 2 or 3 year cycles, like Documenta's 5 year cycle, but it's also very much focused on an international outlook. Sarah Thornton, who wrote 7 Days in the Art World, who has been kind of an influence to the structure of this season, says about the Biennale, it is a Goliath exhibition that is meant to capture the global artistic moment. Or I suppose we could say maybe the zeitgeist. So I'd just like to ask you both, does this definition ring true from your experience? And what could you add to this based on your experiences of being involved in biennales? Clive, would you like to start?
Yeah, sure. So to some degree, it rings true. I think that's a kind of very much the vision of Venice. And Venice has been the oldest and the biggest biennale and has that reputation, that sort of stature, very international, very global. But it was built on the idea of national pavilions. So this is something quite distinct for Venice, is that you have countries that were invited to participate and build physical exhibition pavilions. And that's grown up and continued and expanded over the years to the biggest biennial every 2 years event. The second is São Paulo, which also worked with a different structure. It worked one point with national pavilions, then it did away with it. But they kind of looked at continents at one point and an overmatic theme or thematic at one point. The difference is you get a lot more biennales these days all over the world. So you get regional and you get localized biennials. So you have the Stellenbosch Triennial, for example. It deals with a lot more specific contextual issues. So I think the narrative of the big event has shifted to different scale, to different contexts. There's a Lumbabashi Photo Biennale. So it's becoming a lot more focused in a way. As much as they're international, they're also engaging with local contexts. The Dakar Biennial has been around for a long time. And there's a good fusion of African contextual with an international kind of layer on top of that.
Obviously, Clive has a much broader scope and understanding, more years of experience, I think, in covering different biennales. But the Venice Biennale is still quite interesting because it's still seen as like the big, like Mecca Biennale, but it's still very Eurocentric in my experience. My question was always, who goes to Venice to see these exhibitions? And it was one of the things that came up when people were doing interviews with me a lot, is that, you know, how is this relevant to a local audience or people that can't really go to Venice for a week or two to go and participate or view these exhibitions? So I think it still holds relevance. I mean, I think there's still a lot of different biennales, but the one that still really stands out, or that artists I think also believe makes a big impact in their careers, this one of the Venice Biennale. But it's quite contentious because who gets to go to this thing? And I think that that's your lingering question.
Yeah, that's certainly something that we're interested in kind of explicating, May, as we go through the conversation. But you raise a really important question around why biennales are meaningful and what it is that they actually contribute towards the environment where they're held, but also to the global discourse. So maybe that is kind of a good place to kind of stop for a little bit and kind of explore some of those questions. What would you say are some of the advantages of large-scale exhibitions such as this one, but also some of the limits? So you've kind of pointed to the critiques in some way or the questions, but maybe if you could speak a little bit around, in your own experience, the advantages and limits of these exhibitions.
You know, in the same way where I question like who goes to the Venice Biennale, it's the same question about who comes to South Africa to view art or to see local artists. So I think the significance of the Biennale is quite impactful in the sense that as a national pavilion, you get to showcase artists coming from here and participate in that global dialogue. You know, position yourself kind of on that global stage of art. There are a lot of different things that come about, or from my experience that have come about, you know, the way that we approach the Biennale is maybe very different than other countries. Like here, it's a sort of application process, and Clive can maybe tell us more if it's always been like that, but here you submit an application by group and it gets approved by government, where maybe some other countries, they have a selection committee that chooses certain artists. That's quite different in how we, you know, like people would always ask, you know, are these the best artists to come and represent South Africa in this context? But the way that the process works, in a way, I think is quite interesting because it gives more people the opportunity to have submit a proposal. There are lots of complexities associated with that selection process. But also, you know, it's who's to say you're not the next artist being at the Venice Biennale, because it's such a different process. And the countries do have governing bodies in deciding who's the best artist to go. What gives them the say so for those artists? And then the other thing that, you know, is really a challenge for us has always been funding. We have to do the best we can with the resources that we have. So in our case with the pavilion, I was really proud of what we had achieved, but we had a really great team on the other side and in South Africa who basically said, I want to help you achieve this. You know, you may not have the resources. I had architects and things, everybody helping out and working for minimal pay, in the sense of saying, you know, you don't have a budget. We understand the context of this, but we want to help you make it the best that it can be. So, those are just a few of the things that I find it's so important to be there, because we have to be seen, and it makes our artists relevant. It makes our country relevant. It also shows people the quality of the work that's coming out of South Africa, where people going to Venice would not normally necessarily be traveling to South Africa to come see. They see what's happening at art fairs, but the Venice Biennale stage is very different. You don't have to produce there for commercial purposes. And in a place like Joburg specifically, we're very commercially driven. You know, the fact that we had 3 Joburg-based artists last year showing they could produce works that didn't need to be commercially viable, I think was a big deal. It was quite a big deal for them to be showing there. That's the one thing. But there are different difficulties and complexities associated with how we achieve what we're able to achieve in Venice.
I'd like for us to just kind of backtrack a little bit and go into both of your personal journeys and how you got involved with both of those biennales. So, Clive, I'd like to start with you. Can you give us a context for how the first and second Johannesburg Biennales happened in 95 and 97, respectively? What did the arts landscape look like at that time?
Okay, that's a really interesting and good question and a good way to foreground the issues around the Biennale, Johannesburg in particular. So 1994 is South Africa's first democratic elections. And around that time, the city had birthed a new initiative, like a cultural division, which Christopher Till was director of that division. He was the director of culture for the city of Johannesburg. And this initiative, one of the instruments of that was the idea to put forward a Biennale. And Lorna Ferguson approached Christopher, and they put together a vision for a new democratic country with a new Biennale. A very important model that South Africa had been in a cultural boycott and isolation for 40 years because of apartheid. So there was a lot of like local, regional, artistic competitions, awards. Artists were traveling predominantly locally. Activities were of a localized nature. So the first Biennale was really the advent of opening up the country internationally. Two initiatives were birthed out of that. One was to bring international curators, as they were called, curators from overseas, from various contexts, not just Europe or America, but from Latin America, India, and other places. It's a global consortium who would advise and help develop the model for South Africa. At the time, were very important debates around center and periphery. The idea is that we are marginal, part of the developing world, and so the center was Europe and America. This model brought these curators to meet artists, to engage with the local art community. It was a very democratic process. And the second aspect of that was a young trainee curator program, which I was one of the first recipients of that program. And there were 15 young candidates put forward in this program. So that's how I got to know this and got involved in this initiative. So the model was very inclusive. There were several committees, art community professionals from South Africa, advisory committees, artistic committees, selection panels. But it was really early. This was the birth, the sort of advent of some early video art, installation art. This is 1995. And for the first time, some of those works made it into the country, and it was really opening up the country globally and introducing South African art. And a whole lot of exhibitions and other initiatives and careers were launched off that platform. So it certainly served a purpose. The second Johannesburg Biennale, it followed that there would be a second Biennale following the first one. And the sort of committee or the oversight of the Biennale set up an office called the Africus Institute for Contemporary Art. And it was a sort of head office, the administrative office of the Biennale. There was a gallery space called the Generator Art Space. There was a library and resource center. So that wouldn't just be active every 2 years, but it would be an ongoing service to the art community during the two-year period. It would also host information about other biennales in the world and develop those networks and contacts. The idea was to create an artistic director, and an advert was put out internationally. There were proposals received globally, and Opie Ngwezo was selected as the artistic director of the second Johannesburg Biennale. In that process, there was an emphasis on curatorial vision and direction by the artistic director. It was called Trade Routes, History and Geography. The second Johannesburg Biennale in 1997. And Opie had a very particular globalized vision. It was in two cities, Cape Town and Johannesburg, with six venues. We didn't have the same kind of, wouldn't call it democratic process, but we didn't have all the committees and all the advisory panels and all the experts from South Africa weighing in on the structure of the Biennale, with much more emphasis on the curators. And Opie selected to work with several international curators, put a team together. There was one South African curator, Colin Richards, and then there were several international curators. And there was one venue per curated show. And what we saw there was the advent of this global, international, mega exhibition in Johannesburg in 1997. Sadly, during the course of the Biennale, the city transferred from different political parties and different political dispensations. And during that transfer, financially was unstable, wasn't able to commit to continuing the Biennale. So there was Bongi Dhloma and Opie went out to raise funds to secure the Biennale, to see it to its final running of the exhibition. There was also a lot of press and media and all sorts of discussions around race and identity that came through the conference and through public forums and through publications. But in retrospect, I think the experience of having a Biennale in South Africa was incredible. It's very sad we don't have one now any longer. And it's very important that we are seen at a place like Venice.
Can you maybe kind of give a little sense, paint a bit of a picture on what it looked like? Because you said there was one curated show in each venue. Like, which kind of venues were around in 95? Where was the prominent kind of main space for the Biennale?
Yeah, sure. So in 95, the Electric Workshop was this old big industrial warehouse in Newtown. It was sort of a dust bowl transferring into a cultural precinct. This was the vision of Christopher and the city at the time. It was a really cool space, and Museum Africa was the other very large space just across the way, the precinct in Newtown. And those were the two primary venues. There are a lot of other cluster venues and some smaller venues, but those were the primary ones I remember. The thing, what was interesting with the model, apart from its inclusivity, was that the young curators worked with international foreign curators. So I worked with the curators from France and Israel. Other curators worked with curators from Czechoslovakia or from India or from different countries, and we co-curated exhibitions together with them. So this was a different model to the Venice model of purely a national pavilion. It actually brought South African artists together with international artists on an international pavilion, so to speak. And then there was the key curated core exhibitions, which they always are. It was a lot more mixed, a lot more varied in its diversity and the kind of art that was on display. It would have to be because there were so many voices participating in the process. There was even an internet section. It was a really early, early exhibition, and just some computers in one of the spaces at Museum Africa that I remember. And then there was something called the fringe. So there's a true South African style. This was a very democratic, very broad, open, inclusive process. And Wayne Barker's created something called the lager. These were steel shipping containers placed in Newtown on the precinct. And he invited a whole lot of artists to make installations in these shipping containers. It was also very well received. So you have to imagine a very multicultural, very diverse, very inclusive, very varied in quality and scale and emphasis, with a lot of voices, a lot of different kinds of art. Sometimes you're seeing art from the Congo for the first time in Johannesburg, you know, alongside an artist from India, and all very varied and quite an extraordinary experience. So the second Biennale was a lot more focused, and this was curatorially driven, with a lot of very important artists today who are widely recognized. At the time, perhaps people didn't realize or didn't know. So Yinka Shanabara showed Victorian philanthropist Parla this really early incredible installation, and decades later, it's almost 30 years, 26 years later, you have this phenomenal global artist, William Kentridge, who's become a global figure, was picked up and had a lot of interest expressed from the Biennale. So there were many artists who grew in opportunities from that exposure. But it also heralded the global discourses around post-colonialism, around globalization, that the world we're living in today, in a sense, is a world that Okwi foresaw. Yes, there were criticism. The criticism were two. Okwi noticed that a lot of white South African woman artists were portraying figures of black body, black subject matter in their work. They reacted, and this is South Africa, this is a very fertile, productive, energetic, engaging space. So there were these very lively conversations around that. And the second aspect was, I think for the first time, people experienced there was Wendigo's hair installation, this massive wall of hair hanging in the Electric Workshop. Installations, video work was quite radical. And I think a lot of the press and media didn't fully at the time had come out of the cultural boycott, were in isolation, were not okay with reading the work. It took quite a lot of engagement, and there was some negativity around that as well. But I would see it as productive space. It was critical engagement and necessary work. The work we accept today and so much of what we understand of the art world today, Johannesburg was already doing in 1997. And that's why internationally it has been so recognized, and he was heralded as a very important intellectual and artistic figure because he had that vision. Each of his curators, Hu and Ru, had a show in the Rembrandt van Rijn Gallery, a smaller show. Remember, Boris Isaac Kingile's incredible architectural pieces from Zaire, Congo. Yu Yuan Kim did a show in the Electric Workshop. Some of the big name artists today were part of that process. Togo Zaya was one of the curators, and Okwi did a big show in the Electric Workshop with many, many of the artists we recognize today. So yeah, really, really important, and launched South African art internationally and put us on the map. There were several exhibitions that occurred as a result of that. And I think it allowed us to enter into the international art community and discourse a lot quicker, and accelerated the assimilation into the global art scene.
That's a beautiful picture that you paint, Ty. It seems like it was quite a holistic approach to thinking about how to display art that involved research as well as publication. But Amy, I want to bring you in here and maybe ask you to paint a picture from your experience. Obviously, you're probably speaking from a less historical point of view, but just kind of your time in 2022. If you could paint us a picture of what Venice Biennale looked like, what the process of applying for consideration was, just kind of, you know, what it looks like for someone who has never been. Are there any curated exhibitions as part of the thematics and the pavilions?
Sure. So, I mean, there's obviously an overarching theme selected by or developed by the chief curator last year, Cecilia Alemani, which was The Milk of Dreams, which was based on Leonora Carrington's children's book. And then there were two essentially satellite exhibitions, which were effectively the main exhibitions that she curated, which included a number of invited artists, which included, I think, three or four artists from South Africa as well. So she invites artists to participate in the main exhibitions. And I think that these artists are often artists that have been presented in Venice by the national pavilions. Maybe not all of them, but certainly the awareness of these artists have often come through their exposure in the national pavilion. So there's one in the Giardini and then there's one in the Arsenale where we have a building that we've commissioned for 20 years. That's our building that always our exhibitions, the architectural pavilion and the art pavilion is in the same location. And it's an historical building. It's an old like shipping yard where they'd built the ships, which is what this massive space is. So the interior spaces are very grand in the like triple volume. They're really, really big. And this is sectioned off into the main pavilion. And then the national pavilions have different sections that they rent out for a number of years, or you could rent it per biennale. In the Arsenale, you have to like go through the whole building and then eventually you come up this escalator and then we share a space with Saudi Arabia and Peru. They're always our neighbors. And when you get into that space, it basically is a historical building. So it's brickwork, it's these arched windows. There's nothing really in the space. You have to leave the space as you found it, essentially, after the last pavilion. So you have to build a location, build a space relating to whatever your exhibition is. So that was quite interesting to me because, you know, as opposed to working with spaces that exist, which is normally what you would have. I mean, I think there are a few spaces here that you would be working with the nuances of the space. But in our case, we really had to build a maze structure, which was in our proposal, which we said that we would be creating this maze of filtering through the subconscious of the three artists that we would be presenting or realities of these artists that we were presenting. So that was quite challenging in a big sense because you have to work with architects and because it's an historical building, you really have to deal with health and safety issues, lighting, this kind of stuff. You can't just put holes in the wall. You have to build everything. And then you can imagine if you have limited resources. And in Italy, especially in Venice, I mean, it's so challenging because everything that comes onto the island has to come on by boat. So the logistical issues of working in Venice are quite serious because it just has to be, your production planning has to be so good. Everything that you need has to be there. And then it runs over the Easter period, you can imagine. And they take breaks. So I think every shop is closed at 3 o'clock in the afternoon till like 6 o'clock. So you can't work at a certain time. It's actually tremendously challenging. And it's very different to the way that we work, I think, in Johannesburg. I don't know what the experience was of the Joburg Biennale, but here people get in, everyone jumps in and you can put up stuff. Everyone's helping install and find things, you know where everything is. But there you can't even put a nail in a wall because there's indemnity. It's like a hugely challenging environment to actually physically build an exhibition space. But other for that, you know, you worked with a great team that weren't locals, but they always do the pavilions in Venice. So they were tremendously helpful. And then actually to achieve putting up a beautiful exhibition in that space is quite an achievement. And then you get the benefit of really international curators, the people from the Biennale coming through to a pavilion, visitors. We had so much interest from people like coming from Turkey. I remember Pumlani's work was very, very well received by all kind of Middle Eastern countries and Israel and Spain and so on. We had groups from the photography patrons of the Tate come through. You know, and this is what I'm saying is like, where would these people come in a group to South Africa to come and see some obscure photography exhibition or whatever it may be? So, I mean, there was a lot of interesting visitors, definitely the influx of visitors coming through. There's also, you know, some crazy experiences like Instagram influencers that will all of a sudden be promoting your pavilion or critting your pavilion on the Instagram. The one is Jerry Gagosian, which I don't know if you guys know, but they actually did a walkthrough of our pavilion. And I happened to be at the motel at that particular time that they were there. And I was so stressed because I was on Instagram and I was actually going through my pavilion in the Instagram while they were basically critiquing it. And it was so stressful. But these things happen if we got a good review, thank goodness. But, you know, it's these crazy things that happen. I mean, and then it's the same experience. I think it's so exciting listening to what's happened in the Joburg Biennale because I think that that is so valuable for the environments that we have in Joburg. I mean, bringing international curators, actually contextualizing our art and our artists in our own context. And I wish also that something like that existed as well, because in a place like Venice, you can tell the best story that you can, but you have to tell it with the complexity of our cultures and our people. And it's very difficult to do that because you're also very much in competition with all these other things going on. I mean, at the same time, we were competing, not competing, you know, you feel like it's, they do say it's an Olympics of the art world, and you do in a sense compete because you always see it in relation to other countries. But at that time, everything was about what's happening in Russia and the Ukraine and, you know, that the dynamics between those spaces. I remember with a very early get together of all the curators, everybody kind of pledged solidarity with Ukraine. And it was also very much based on COVID, you know, how we've come out of the pandemic. And when you're looking at that, you kind of question the relevance of your own message. Like, what is it that we are saying that actually speaks to this global context where people are going through some serious issues and where are we positioned in that dialogue? So, you know, and again, I think that that is one of the reasons why it's important to be a participant in something like the Venice Biennale. You need to make a case, but also you see where you're at and the problems become small. They're not small, but they, you know, you see it in relation to where we are as human beings in the world. So I don't know if that is enough answering of your question, because you can really go on a long time about these things. But I think that there's so much value in this crossover influx of information, whether it be South Africans in Venice or international curators and artists and whoever coming to our country and having that exchange. It's just a very important exchange that happens in no matter what space you're in.
That's very interesting, particularly around the politics of the work, because one of the things that we were talking around and thinking about reflecting on 95 and 97 is that it felt as if the works that the artists were proposing and exhibiting felt much more overtly political. And we were kind of wondering what this shift is between the kinds of works that were presented in 95 versus the kinds of works that you see in today. What is the artist's responsibility in reflecting the politics of the place where they come from, both kind of historically, but also today? And I'm going to ask this question to both of you, but maybe start with you, Clive.
I think what is the responsibility of artists in terms of producing political work, I think is a question for artists. From a curatorial and a biennale and a museum and institutional perspective, you did rightly notice that it appears in some way that the work produced in 95 or 97 was more political, and perhaps there's a difference in the work produced today. So part of that is what's happened to South Africa and by extension, the art ecosystem in South Africa during that 30-year period. So artists at the time, it was a much more political time, and you just came out of apartheid and you just came out of a lot of very fraught and dynamic political experiences that artists were portraying in very rich and complex ways. I think at the same time, it's very necessary that the work evolves and it doesn't always have to be political. But what has changed is we no longer have a Biennale and we no longer have very healthy public art museums and by extension, collections and thematic and curated exhibitions in South Africa. Recently, in the last less than a decade, we've seen the growth of some new private museums or institutions. But we have a very strong and active commercial art sector. This is art auction houses, art galleries, and art fairs. So the commercial sector is dominating a lot and mediating that space to the public. Good and bad. It's wonderful, and all credit to the people who are doing the work. But if you think of Venice, not only for the Biennale, you think of Italy, you think of Documenta in Germany, any of these places, New York, the Whitney, Biennial, you have a very healthy art ecosystem that consists of Biennale's commercial art activity, but also public art museums, curated exhibitions, big traveling exhibitions. It's a much fuller, broader, deeper kind of art ecology. And I think that's what's happened. There's a lot of pressure on young artists here to succeed at a very early age. And they're interpreting success as commercial gallery exhibitions. And that's, if anything, a call to rehab a Johannesburg Biennale or Biennale in South Africa amongst healthy, good public art museums, because you have a large population that needs to be educated. It's wonderful our artists travel overseas. They're seeing Venice, they're collected by the Tate. But this, in the end, it turns out to be a handful of people. And what you need to do is also address the local context. And you need to educate and develop a local art community, art audience, art collectors, philanthropists, institutions, a much broader-based education process, and education in a very broad sense, exposure to good international, local art in a much broader systemic way through the art ecosystem in South Africa. So I think something of that has changed from the first Biennales to South Africa showing artists overseas now. There's a very active art market that's mediating a lot of the work that's produced. So who is our artist producing work for? And to some degree, the Venice Biennale or Biennales, Tate, the international, this is the elite of the arts system. So that also creates another kind of migratory culture that moves from one event to another. If they're not at Basel, they're at Venice, and then they're at Tate. Well, that's one very narrow layer of sector of the global art community who's able to do that. So it's important to have institutions, archives, knowledges in the context where the artists are producing work. That'll produce a very vibrant, sustainable art ecosystem, one which we actually, at this point, I think, really need.
Yeah, I'd like to come back to the way in which the Biennale communicates with the city, but I just want to ask Ame the same question that Nkopeleng asked about the responsibility of the artists to produce work that is representative of the socioeconomic politics of the country they come from. But I also would like you to answer that question whilst explaining to us the premise of your exhibition, Into the Light, and your decision around including Phumlani Ntuli, Roger Ballen, and Leboga Nkganye in your exhibition.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I do agree with Clive in the sense that, you know, an artist's prerogative to be political or not political is their decision. But, you know, the message that artists give about their country or where it is that they come from, I think is quite interesting from my experience. What I've seen very much so in this day and age is that artists are dealing with personal narratives. Our three artists are all dealing with social political issues from their own context. You know, in a way, let's say with Roger Ballen, there was quite a few questions as to where he fits into that, because he's not South African born, but he's been here since the 70s, and he's actually created quite an impactful footprint in the sense of creating a new genre in photography that he asserts, which is a very personal journey that he's on, but very well known throughout, you know, the entire world. And also to note, all three of these artists are independent artists. They're not with galleries. They're not necessarily producing overtly commercial work. But I think to cross over, maybe jump into the question in different ways. I mean, our pavilion, really, the theme of the pavilion was Into the Light, but it really spoke to three different scenarios that each of these artists portrays, you know, and the way that we curated it was essentially dealing with Kumlani's narratives first, where he's dealing from cultural concerns about archiving and representation. And, you know, when these archives get extracted, how they get interpreted, you know, and he was bringing back his own voice in his works and his animations and also dealing with it from a futuristic perspective. So I saw that as quite a broad overall world that people can engage in more broadly in social context and learn about South Africa and learn about the complexities of modernist painting, or, you know, and then the repositioning of these figures and who these figures are within a futuristic context, because he had included augmented reality elements. He had included this. And it was interesting because he was one of the few artists at the Biennale who actually had an augmented reality element. And that was brought to us by one of the visitors. They said that, you know, this is one of the few things that they had seen at the pavilion that actually had digital technology, which I found so fascinating in this day and age. And I really commend him for it. And it was very experimental work. But that's also brave, you know, that's very brave of him to have brought in this element which, where it wasn't fully developed. And then with Lebohang, you know, she dealt with her body of work called Black to Fairy Tales, which was really an early body of work that she had done at the Market Photo Workshop, which wasn't necessarily, one would say, if she had more time, because that's the other complexity we have, our artists don't have a lot of time to prepare for the Biennale. If she had more time, she would have probably produced a different body of work. But this body of work in particular dealt with the fantasy elements that connected to Cecilia Alemani's issue of the milk of dreams. You know, who are we? What do we become in our dreams? If we could craft a future for ourselves, where does that stem from? So we're going deeper into my kind of personal situation, which was her trying to resonate in her own way with Western fairy tales that dictate to young girls like what they should aspire to, when she's coming from this township context where the big castle and the prince on a white horse doesn't necessarily exist, you know. So she was reinterpreting herself as these rag dolls or the snow black in her mother's house in Katlehong or whatever, in her grandmother's house. And then from there, we went to kind of more the inner psyche of Roger Ballen's own mind, where he dealt with where dreams actually come from. And, you know, in dreams, the parables, the connectivity is dreams and nightmares at the same time. And he made this beautiful light box installation where it felt like you were actually in someone's mind and really dealing with the horrors of dreaming and being terrified, but also, you know, grappling with what you can imagine for yourself and how that goes forward. So that was really the journey of our exhibition in the context of the overall theme. But again, you know, I mean, for me, these artists are all dealing with their own personal context. And that to me was quite interesting because they are political in their own ways. And what I find looking at them is that I'm now learning about people that, like in Pumlani's work, archived material of people I've never heard of, and a construction of this figure moving through different spaces in Johannesburg, also moving through paintings, also thinking about where these people positioned in landscapes where we never saw before, like those works that were actually produced for another exhibition called Liewe Land, which was curated by Dineke van der Walt at the Voortrekker Monument, where she found these posters of modernist paintings without any figures in them. So it was an interesting conversation about our institutions, our culture, what gets put into museums, what gets excluded, and what the messages pervade through our archives. And then learning more about, you know, township culture and learning more about, you know, young girls in South Africa, what their aspirations are. And it was interesting with Lebohang because she is actually shows more internationally. And the work that people find the most interesting of hers at the moment is reinterpreted photographs of her mother, where she's inserted herself into these photographs in the same dresses of her mum. You know, it's like dealing with memory, and she's dealing with the aftermath of the apartheid years, but from her own context. So, I mean, these personal narratives have become extremely important. And I think that why I feel that's significant is that we can't really disregard our history or disregard the issues that we face. But what we can do is try and understand the different contexts from where everyone comes from and saying why they're angry or why they're struggling or why they're more accepting of others. And I think that that was, for me, quite a powerful message to be bringing to an international group that may, you know, if you're looking at news from South Africa, it's necessarily very negative. There's lots of corruption. There's lots of all these things going on. But, you know, as a culture and as a country, I think we work towards more of an understanding of each other. And I think that that's very positive. And I think that that's something that very much manifests in Joburg, is us trying to work together now to build something new. And that's, for me, you know, when we understand where everyone's coming from and we allow each other to be a part of that story and to understand that story, there can be space for healing, because we are still, I mean, very much healing from all of that stuff. You can't have a political stance because it's so messy at the moment. We can only deal with these personal narratives.
I'm thinking about, you know, the artists that get chosen to represent a national pavilion. And I can imagine there's a lot of pressure to pick people that kind of represent a country in a sense. And how does that, you know, what was your process of thinking about those three artists and how the three of them might represent a different narrative of the country?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a tricky question, because again, like, who do you decide who is necessarily the best? It's not to say that these artists are necessarily the best. I think in this context, you presenting a theme that connects with an overarching theme, and you're thinking about artists who are speaking to that. Maybe in terms of accessibility, there are some situations where artists are not keen to participate. It's a very difficult process, I think, that we go through here, in the sense of, you know, pulling together. And it's often people, I mean, in our situation, we had a team of people who didn't necessarily know each other that well, to be honest, you know, and it's really tough. I think that teams have gone through, you have to choose artists that are communicating the message that you want to communicate in the context of the overall theme, right? And then you draw on your resources of people that you know, because as I mentioned earlier, the process of selecting, you know, I might maybe inviting another artist who I've never worked with, and they're going to be like, well, why? This is quite, you know, the timeline is short. Where are we going to get the funds? I don't know you. I've never worked with you. You know, so they may not all be willing to necessarily participate in that, but you find a group of people that are willing to go on this journey with you. And as I said, you do the best that you can, and we participate in it. You draw on the resources that you have. I mean, I don't know if that fully answers maybe your question about it. It is a very difficult situation. But again, as I say, because it's kind of application process, like, you're going to choose the people in your network, or you're going to choose the resources that you have available to you that can make this project work. And then whether you get selected or not is kind of by God's grace, I guess.
God's grace. In some ways, this is a very difficult conversation and a critique, because we are still kind of centering the Western gaze. But of course, it's important to recognize the value of participating on the global stage. And that's why this conversation is interesting to us. But I guess my question to you, Clive, is, given kind of where Amy has taken us, would you say that we need more African biennales, or should we encourage more participation on the continent for those that already exist? And what are some of the ways in which we could do that?
I mean, it helps to reflect back on the last 20, 30 years to the previous biennales, because at that moment, it was about opening the country up, what we use a very broad term called internationally. But I think we weren't really fully aware what that was. It was almost anything international. And of course, immediately Europe and America come through the door. Sadly, South African artists, South African culture hadn't had a lot of contact on the continent for a very long time. And it's something that's emerged more recently. And the narratives now, particularly in the commercial art market, are very strong around contemporary African art. So there's art fair dedicated to contemporary African art. We've seen a lot more focus in the media on contemporary African artists. We've seen subgenres of, like, black figuration coming through the art system. And a lot of the narratives around subjectivity and personal narratives embedded in those kind of discourses. This is very positive and very strong. Picking up on your question related to the continent, I think you have with the Dakar Biennial, we had a Johannesburg Biennale. Dakar Biennale is going really strong and a very important event, predominantly regional and continental in a way, with some international flavor. And then you have Lumbabashi Photo Biennale. And I think there's a move, there's a small Biennale or something in Morocco that's localized. But it's a very big continent with a lot of complex and a lot of multiple histories, a lot of diversity. I think there's certainly opportunities for more contact within the continent. And also I would extend that to the global south. So I think there are a lot of common questions that come up related to practice, identity, personal narrative, relate to what others have gone through in places like Latin America and Brazil, for example, or Cuba, or places like Argentina, or places like India. Certainly in the continent, there are small initiatives, but they seem to come and go. It has increased since the Biennale days back then, but it's not the same as the kind of networks and infrastructure and support and ecosystems we see in Europe, for example. There are so many Biennales, so many events, so many museums, so many opportunities. So I think there's a call for increased residencies, exchanges, artist initiatives, Biennales, traveling shows that should be happening in the continent. There are complexities, the cost of traveling in the continent, the logistics of getting things around, but this is becoming the same internationally these days. It's getting a lot more complex. It would be incredible to see some sub-Saharan African art exhibitions, you know. So I think what has to happen, you have to have another stream that develops alongside the commercial sector. It feels like they're doing their job. They're participating in the fairs. They're doing their exhibitions. They're nudging all the museums. They're looking for collectors. But I feel like there's a stream between the nonprofits, the artists, the curators, the NGOs, museums on the ground to work within the continent. Often these initiatives are driven by outside foreign agencies or development entities from France. There's a Yale initiative. And I'm thinking these initiatives should be developed by people on the continent for the continent. There's already enough knowledge here that there's really scope for something to develop in the continent.
I think this idea of what Clive just said about the resources available on the continent is a good segue to the question to Amay about, you know, what kind of support the government actually gives for the Venice Biennale. I mean, we are one of few African countries to have pavilions at the Biennale. So, you know, the government obviously sees value in us being there. How does it work with the funding, the support that you receive from the government, and what potentially bigger role can they play in that support?
So, I mean, yeah. So with your proposal, you need to submit quite a comprehensive budget that outlines everything. And there is, from my experience, no real flexibility in the budget. It's not like when they approve your proposal with the budget, there's any leeway, there's no more funding, you know, that's what they've dedicated. And these things kind of, you can imagine with big government institutions, they have to allocate that budget and then there's nothing more, you know. And I think that's one of the big points of contention is that, you know, how much could you put aside for art, you know, in a country like ours that needs so much, you know? So you have to submit, you have to produce your budget. I mean, and then that's really it. You can find additional funding. Like we had additional funding from places like Barlow World, which covered our shipping. Yeah, the grasp is quite tight from my understanding. I mean, our project manager mainly dealt with a lot of the funding issues, but we, for example, couldn't have any funding from people who would sponsor alcohol or anything like that, you know, so there were certain rules that we couldn't have. But I mean, one of the agreements that can be put in place is that you get a certain amount of funding from the government, which is not a lot. I mean, because to be honest, you need about something like 8 million rand or something to be producing a quality pavilion in Venice. And, you know, we worked with a budget of 2 million, give or take, you know, because that's what was allocated to us. And then what I was saying about, you know, whenever I speak to this about people, they're like, oh my gosh, like, how did you do that with 2 million? You know, we don't know. But as I say, we had so much help from our arts community in Joburg, architects that are friends, but that understand the process, that said, you know, I would normally charge X amount, but I'm going to charge you a 10% of what I would normally charge you to help you build this pavilion. And then we worked with people from Slovenia, where if you work directly with people from Italy, it would be much more expensive, but they helped us get the most affordable drywall, or, you know, they cut their fees and so on. I don't know how we got so lucky with these people, but, you know, they, you need to work into the contracts that you can actually find funding from elsewhere. But now the broader issue with that is that it got announced in like February and the Biennale was in April. So by the time you're able to announce that you're the team representing South Africa, and the time it takes to generate funding from private institutions, corporate companies, or whoever, their budgets are already set for the year. You know, they've already done their budget planning. So it's very difficult to find additional funding to be, you know, supplementing what you get from the government. And again, you know, that thing about government funding is that how do you make a case that you need 10 million or 8 million rand when there are people here that don't have food or housing or education, or, you know, what value is that? And that's what brings me back to what is the value of South Africa being present in a place like Venice that's so elitist that our people can't go there? It's very foreign to them, to the arts community. Half the arts community doesn't understand what the Venice Biennale is about or why we should be there. In the arts, like general arts community, we understand the impact of that, but it never comes home, you know, and we never see the fruits of these labors necessarily for these artists. Like Clive was saying, you know, it's one artist in however many thousands of artists that are actually being shown at the Tate or whatever. And I think at the same time, we have to work with the restrictions of what we're dealing with in terms of putting up the pavilion. But there should be initiatives to bring the exhibitions back home to make people more aware or get people more interested in it in advance, so that you actually have funders or private institutions being part of that application process and saying, you know, you want to put together a team. If you get it, I will sponsor you X amount of money that will help you pay for flights. Or do you know, one of the challenges we had was not really having an adequate media activity, because Wi-Fi, we couldn't install permanent Wi-Fi in our pavilion. So you can't do talks, you can't do these kind of live things that bring it back and contextualizes what it is that you're doing there. So it's very difficult for companies and organizations to understand the relevance of what's happening in Venice. So yeah, I mean, it's very complex, I think, the funding and the resources. But at the same time, you have to work at putting it in a context and saying, what are people benefiting and what are organizations benefiting from their participation in this event? And what are they getting back? And I think that, you know, generally, like Clive was saying, it's a huge problem, not just in South Africa, but globally. I mean, we're very lucky that we've got a commercial sector. Like, I know in places like Berlin, it's very difficult for artists, especially South African artists that I've spoken to, who now permanently live in Berlin, that have all the exhibition and residency opportunities that they could dream of, but no commercial viability of their work. So they want to sell here, but they're out of context. So it's like, it's so messy. But, you know, we don't have the resources for residencies and all these kind of things, which is essential here, but we've at least got the commercial backing of our galleries and all these kind of things happening. But it's, yeah, we need more interest in, I guess, what we're doing here.
Maybe I just want to pick up there, if I can. I think we just be careful we don't do ourselves out of a South African pavilion. So in a sense, art doesn't need to justify itself in that way. So it's very important we don't misunderstand the importance of the event and South African artists' exposure overseas at the same time. It's not an either-or scenario. It's a case of we have a particular art ecosystem at the moment which is heavily weighted on the commercial, which is good, but we need these other things like strong public art museums, NGOs, etc. At the same token, it's very important South Africa has a pavilion at the Venice Biennale. And justifying the money, the kind of numbers we're talking about in reality are so small compared to corporate events, to government expenditure on a number of issues, to a whole range of other things, that what we actually get out of it outweighs the investment. So symbolically, that puts South Africa alongside so many other nations, and that's where we want to be as a nation, as a country, have that kind of visibility. So we need to recognize and applaud the South African government's support for the Venice Biennale and for the funding they do give that is important. And there are challenges with it. And I'm wondering a little bit more about that. And if you were speaking earlier, Emma, about, for example, in France, they will appoint a commissioner, which is like a curator who will select artists. Process works a little bit different here. It's like a tender process. And you have to qualify with a whole lot of qualifying criteria to be selected. And I'm wondering if we shouldn't be thinking about a different model for the selection process that would build in more time for the things you've suggested, which are actually quite noteworthy, like the Wi-Fi doing events, bringing that pavilion back to South Africa, showing it. It sounds like really worthy initiatives that would enhance and amplify the work that is done there. But it's not a case of it being nullified in any way. It's very important it happens. But perhaps some of those mechanisms could be improved on and would give us more of a, let's say, in air brackets, competitive edge, in a sense, because in a way, you're not competing, but you are competing. You're being looked at globally across the world for a particular time. And to be honest, Venice runs for a very long time. A large amount of the international art world community descends on Venice. It is a spotlight. Applaud the government for doing that and standing by it and making it happen. But perhaps there could be some improvements on how that works.
Yeah, I mean, I fully agree with you. And I also just want to clarify that there's no criticism on the government part of the amount of funding. I'm saying in the context of how it gets funded, you can understand the amounts that are allocated to art in a developing area such as ourselves. So, you know, definitely so grateful to be a part of that and that we actually have presence. And like Anthea was saying, I think there were only 9 African countries or something that were present at the Venice Biennale, and it's growing, which I think is so important. And it's so important for us to be a part of that dialogue. What I'm also saying, just to clarify on that point, is that it is achievable with the smaller budget. That is the case. But in order to have more resources, we can plan better or do better, or, you know, even like you were saying, just have more time. Or keeping it in mind, I think maybe is the thing, because I know the other issue that is quite a big issue is that the information from different teams is not necessarily transferred. You know, each team who's done a pavilion every second year, no one speaks to each other. So no one knows what the issues are, what they're dealing with. And I think that there, you know, kind of could be a gathering of people who are willing to participate in that. I certainly would be saying, you know, this is what we dealt with in order to help the next team and the next team, or putting together a docket of information where they can go through those things and look at the budgets and look at, you know, the contacts and all those things. And I think the transferring of information on the biennales is an essential part of having success in the next pavilion, or having, you know, because I think limitations are interesting because it really shows what you're able to produce and how good you, I mean, if you had 10 years to produce it, you may not produce a better product than you could in 4 or 5 months necessarily. I mean, pressure is always, it can be a good thing. But I think having all the information to your disposal really puts you in a position of knowledge and power, and, you know, gives you the resources that you need in order to achieve the goal that you want to achieve. And what we want to achieve is to be a participant on that platform and be a driving force in whichever way, or to have a conversation with these people and meet these people, especially where it doesn't exist in South Africa. So I think that there definitely should be, you know, the thing that I feel we should focus on is really just an exchange of this information and coming together. It's a very secretive process. I don't know if anyone understands how, you know, no one really wants to talk about it, or no one really wants to, they don't know who to contact, because who do you contact? Who do you know where to go? And I think that something like this podcast is quite interesting for the next team to be learning at the different complexities of putting this thing together. But yeah, it was Kaka and Ka. We brought the exhibition by invitation of the curator of the arts festival, and it was so well received. And, you know, it was so, people were so excited to be seeing the exhibition, even though it was in Oudtshoorn and very few people saw it. Some people saw it, and we wanted to do more with that. But what ultimately ended up happening is we paid for that. Me and the artists, we paid to bring the exhibition to South Africa, and you can only do that up to a point. You know, we never were able to produce a catalog or any, you know, we could do it, but with our own resources. And that became very challenging because you're dealing with, again, artists who are independent. And, you know, myself putting my own resources into it, which was a pleasure to do. But that's what you're dealing with at the end of the day. And I think that that's where we need to create more awareness of the relevance of this platform to our artists, so that we can get more people behind us, so we can do more and tell more people about it.
I definitely think that budget problems and the question of resources do tend to antagonize local audiences and kind of people who are looking on to what's going on. And of course, Clive, in 95, similar kinds of conversations were going on with the 11 million rand that keeps getting quoted as, you know, an amount that was badly managed, where people kind of felt like the funding was late, it didn't come in on time, it wasn't quite what it was expected to be. But in your response to Ame now, you said that South Africa absolutely has to have a national pavilion. And you spoke about the symbolic gesture. And I kind of want to push back a little bit on that and ask you to maybe explain what you mean by has to. Why do we have to have a national pavilion?
I mean, if you want to look at it instrumentally, like, no, you don't have to. But when we look at it artistically and we look at the kind of work that is produced in South Africa, it's very important that it gets seen in a bigger, broader international paradigm. So the arts are showing in public museums overseas, they're showing in commercial galleries, they're showing in art fairs. Venice Biennale is possibly, arguably, apart from Documenta, one of the most important global art platforms that exists. So the imperative has to be, is an urgency that it should not be lost or removed or defunded in any way, but it's something that is a very important platform for our artists and curators to recognize the curating process in this. And I do think the question around funding and resources is kind of endemic to the art world. I think we are a fay with that. There's never enough in a sense, or we have to work well with the resources that are available. I remember at the Johannesburg Art Gallery, Africa Remix was happening. It was only happening in Europe. It had traveled to Tokyo and had the idea to go and bring the exhibition back to South Africa to show what contemporary African art looks like in Johannesburg to a South African audience. There was no funding for that, and funding has to be found. And that's kind of endemic to the arts industry. But I think it's part of this message of the kind of what can be achieved, what can be done with little resources, and how much symbolic traction can be obtained from those kind of investments. And art is just one of those things that it's so intrinsic to human value. I was recently on a research trip in Peru, actually in the Amazon, and staying within a community there, and our artist called Marita. We're talking about community that's 5 hours up the river. They're isolated. They live in the Amazon of a jungle. One of the activities that she does is she makes bark paintings. So you collect bark, turn it into a liquid, collect the mud, and paint these incredible geometric patterns. This is not funded. There's no way to sell it. She makes it because it's part of the culture, the tradition, part of the identity, part of the how they belong, how they tell their stories, and how you imagine yourself and your place in the world. There is no financial value on that kind of thing. So art by in itself is significant, like culture, for society. Now we're dealing with the pragmatic elements of that. It's absolutely imperative that South Africa has a pavilion at Venice. The question I'm asking is the mechanisms of how that process works. And perhaps that could be explored in different ways. Perhaps it doesn't have to be a tender process. It could be opened up to curators or more artistically driven through a curatorial initiative rather than through a tender kind of process. It would be interesting to see a different method for that.
Yeah. I just want to have a little anecdote about Africa Remix. Clive was the director of the Johannesburg Art Gallery at that time and brought the project to the museum. And that's actually when I met Clive when I was a student. I was in fourth year and I was the coordinator of the artist liaison. So there was a group of students and I was the coordinator for all the artists that had come in. And that's when I met Clive. How many years ago? Oh my gosh. Was it 2007?
Yeah, something like 2007. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So I feel like we have a lot of nostalgia about the Johannesburg Biennale. And Clive, you just mentioned that South Africa needs a pavilion. Does South Africa need a Biennale? Is it possible? Do we want one? What might a Biennale in Johannesburg in 2024 look like? And also just broadly, you know, what does a Biennale do for a city? I think of nation building, globalization, tourism. How would the benefits of a Biennale kind of work with Joburg now? And is it possible? And do we even want one?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question because on the face of it, immediately want to jump to a place of, yeah, absolutely, we need a Biennale. Let's have another Johannesburg Biennale. There's a lot of criticism out there that there are too many biennials in the world. But then there's a lot of criticism about everything in the art world. So we just set that aside for a minute and just go down a few notches. I kind of think, let's just look at Johannesburg through the eyes of some other African cities for a minute. So if I think of Dakar and Senegal and Senghor's vision for Pan-Africanism and a kind of place as a meeting point for a melting pot of African ideas, logics, knowledges, languages, culture. And it's a very vibrant and fertile, and it's been going for a long time. And it definitely enriches the art community. Otherwise, I think it would suffer from some isolation. There's incredible network. It feels like it's the rabbit and the hare, and it's the hare. And Joburg was the rabbit, and rabbit ran fast and went big quick and then died and lost the race. And the good old faithful tortoise has faithfully kept on, and Dakar is still there and still growing, still evolving in its very particular kind of localized regional way, in really interesting ways, actually. It hasn't jumped for like the limelight and trying to get the best curators. It has a very quirky model that mixes, but so it's been a bedrock and a feeding place for ideas, knowledge, creative practice, design, music, a whole lot of spin-offs that come off that biennial. It's not a biennial purely servicing the international global art community like Venice. Then you have something like the Lubumbashi Photo Biennale. It's started by artists because there's a need. There's not much happening in that place. They come out of a war zone. They have quite a fraught historical legacy, a lot of trauma. And these are artists saying, let's get together and do something, create an initiative, because we need to see things happen. We want to break the isolation. We want to reach out. So I think there's questions for us to say, what would that biennale look like? I don't know if hand women have to put some effort and thought into that process. But I do like taking it through those other biennales. It's not automatically we're talking about Venice here. It may be a different kind of event that sees to more localized needs while marrying some of the international exposure and benefits that could come. You've mentioned some like tourism and putting South Africa on the international art map. Because what happens is there's a twofold process. One is the artists going out and international curators coming here, but it also feeds the local art community, which grows from the exposure and from the exchange. That can't happen on an event like Venice or where it's a handful of people remotely. So I think there's some spin-off and exchange that could happen if we had a big international event here. And certainly the timing and the broader emphasis on contemporary African art is there. And there's certainly a need for infrastructure. And I use the Biennale in a broader sense, archives, libraries, an art magazine in South Africa, criticism, journalism. So there's, it feels like there are a whole lot of spin-offs that could come from such an initiative. And there was the Stellenbosch Triennale, or I think it still is, and it's localized and it's done some wonderful things. So if you expand that concept in a bigger way, not from Stellenbosch, but just the idea of a Biennale in an African city, as a country like ours is imagining itself, with so much good art that's being produced, I do think there's space for it, yeah.
Actually, just, you know, what I wanted to say in addition to that is really just an expression of support, I think, for what our local artists and curators and writers and, you know, art practitioners in South Africa would benefit from the influx of other professionals all over the world coming in or other artists. And I think that, you know, again, coming back to the capabilities of people in this country that may or may not be able to travel worldwide to be seeing world-class exhibitions or speaking to world-class curators or learning something from them. I mean, that is something that really excites me about having a Joburg Biennale, and would not want to imagine what it would look like in 2024 because it's December now. But, you know, in the future, for sure, I think that what our arts community and our arts practitioners could be benefiting from an event like that would be tremendous, because there are things like institutional personnel, academics and so on that get to travel to different symposiums and give papers and speak to people. But the majority of our community and our arts community and our artists have never had the opportunity to go to the Tate or to Venice or to wherever. And how important I think that is to be communicating on an international level on home soil, you know, where people can understand their context, but where they can have a broader worldview and something more to aspire to. You know, many people have said that the biggest reason that they have achieved success is because of the exposure that they gained as young people in aspiring to more. And I think that's something that the Joburg Biennale or another Joburg Biennale and more people coming here and sharing their experience and training and teaching and having skills exchange could offer our arts community.
That feels like a really wonderful place to end off. You've kind of offered us with some really kind of holistic ways of thinking about the potential that Biennales hold, whilst at the same time holding it to, you know, a standard of critique to say, what are the resources that we're spending? Who's benefiting? Why are they even here? But I think the thing that I'm walking away with is just a very kind of holistic view of what a Biennale can offer, which is something that I didn't necessarily walk into the conversation thinking about. So from my side, I just want to thank you so much for making the time to have this conversation and to share some of your thoughts and your experiences.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you all. I really appreciate it.
A special thank you to our wonderful guests for contributing their insights and valuable time to our discussion. Your engagements have added so much depth to our understanding of this industry. Our sincere gratitude goes out to you, our dear listeners, for engaging with this conversation. If today's episode resonated with you, we encourage you to subscribe to Unframed on your podcast app and express your support by leaving a review or follow and engage with us on social media. Your ongoing encouragement is integral to the continued success of Unframed. Season 4 of Unframed was made possible by the generous support of the National Arts Council. Thank you to our dedicated team, our project manager, Neve Walsh-Foster, our sound engineers, This Audio Is Visual and The Audio Room, social media strategist, Alex Carolus, and graphic designer, Sanele Balintaba. This brings another episode of Unframed to a close. Thank you for being part of our community.